My name is Mike Harris. I'm currently a finance editor for VeteransToday.com. But in my past life, I have spent most of my adult career working in the semiconductor industry. I worked for a small company called Motorola. Did a variety of topics for them. I was what we call a captive subcontractor for them. I have worked in the investment banking field and have done things financial as a result of my relationship with Motorola that took us there, and been sort of watching with somewhat chagrin what has been happening in the world around us here for the last decade or two.
Well, I mean, in a way, your experience with Motorola is fascinating, isn't it? Because this was part of the outsourcing, shipping out of various expertise and industry from the United States, similar to what we've had here in Europe, which Donald Trump was trying to address. So I wonder if you could just tell us what was going on at Motorola. Semiconductors, obviously, very important part of high-tech work, which is not just given to any old country like, say, Angola or something to do. So can you tell us what happened in the semiconductor industry? Because I understand that Motorola was investing big in the US and several places which they constructed, just as the trade rules opened up. They decided, well, actually, even though we built this place, we're not really going to use it much, and we would much rather start building things in China and Taiwan, places like that. So, yeah, just take us through that whole sort of, I suppose it was the brain drain. We had in the 1960s the brain drain here from the UK over to the US for the space program and things like that. They called it the brain drain. But you in the US have had a similar thing, haven't you?
Well, we have. My involvement with Motorola, when I was with them primarily, they were building all of their wafer fabs in the U.S. and would do assembly and test work overseas. That was going good until Motorola elected to build the first facility in China. There was a place called Tianjin. Motorola invested over $2 billion of shareholder equity to build a facility there with the promise that China would open up their domestic market for them, for their cell phones and pagers and other Motorola products. Somehow the facility got built over there, and I argued against this. I had direct conversations with the chairman and CEO about this and saying, look, if you build a facility there, within 2 years they're gonna have your intellectual property because they'll steal it. Within 5 years they'll own the factory. Well, guess who owns the factory today? A company called CIMIC, which is Chinese, and they own it. So I had that argument, I lost that argument. But Motorola, that was the beginning of the end. And what China saw in Motorola was the world's premier telecommunications company. And they decided that they wanted the company. They wanted the technology. So China, through a series of cutouts, made large investments in a series of private equity firms and challenged them to take Motorola down. And they did this by putting... buying up shares and putting people on Motorola's board that were not allied to the founding family, the Galvin family. And they managed to hijack the company and force the breakup and sale of it. So those assets are now primarily controlled by China, what was Motorola's premier business. That includes the Motorola cell phones. Right down to this day, they're manufactured by a Chinese company. All Motorola is left of the old company now is just a brand, a label, and that's all that's left of them.
Isn't it interesting, because surely the Pentagon and the U.S. government generally, the U.S. military particularly, I would have saw this as a strategic industry. It's all gone.
Well, not all of it. Motorola did manage. They had a group called the Government Electronics Group, and that was acquired by Northrop Grumman. And so they took that over. They're the ones who built the satellites. They're the ones who built a lot of the military electronics for everything from radios at the platoon level all the way up to encrypted communications that would circumnavigate the world, nuclear submarines alike. But that was retained as a U.S. asset. But the rest of the company was stripped off and has a lot of Chinese ownership at this point in time.
What about Taiwan then? Because that's also well known as a semiconductor production country.
Well, it is. Motorola had a presence there. And a phenomena happened in the mid-90s where the cost of capital rose so high, and the cost and risk of building a wafer fab became so big that a lot of companies were not willing to take that risk and build it. So they started going to a foundry model, where you would take your designs and give them to a foundry, and then the foundry would make the device to your specifications and return it to you. That's what the largest foundry in the world is TSMC, which is a Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, and they've just decided to reverse their course, and they're putting a $19 billion wafer fab facility in Phoenix, Arizona. And then a week or two ago, they announced plans for a second wafer fab going into Phoenix, Arizona. So that's where Motorola was headquartered for the semiconductor group. And now all of those technologies are returning. You have to remember, back in 1998, Motorola was the largest producer of semiconductors globally, both in dollar volume and unit volume. And so that has come full circle now, to where it's returned from whence it came, from Taiwan back to the USA, back in Phoenix.
Okay, well, look, here's a $64,000 question for you. Are these semiconductors hackable? In other words, can you get into them remotely and mess with them and or listen into everything that's sort of whizzing around in there?
Well, the very first article I wrote for Veterans Today back in 2011 addressed the hacking of and capture by Iran of the top secret drone that the U.S. was flying over Iran. And people wondered how they can do it, how they can do it. Well, I'll tell you how they can do it. Whenever you trust your process, your manufacturing process, to a third party, whether they're Taiwanese or Chinese or whatever, they have control over what you build. You do not. You relinquish it when you give them the task of building your product. So what China was doing was they would build the product to the specification, but they would add additional layers of circuitry within those semiconductors, so that they could hack, so that they could take control of electronic systems via the devices that comprise that system, via the whether it's a microprocessor or any number of 20, 30 other devices that could be in these devices. But they have the ability, by adding additional circuitry, and the device will perform well, it'll perform to spec, it'll do everything you expect it to. It just does a lot more than what the original manufacturer's design says it's going to do. And that was one of the clever things that was done. The U.S. military is really, really vulnerable with this at this point in time.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? You're giving somebody a specification, blueprints or whatever, to build something, and they're saying, well, here it is. But actually, what they've done is they've built a little back door into it that they haven't told you about. Well, what about listening to semiconductors? Because, I mean, it's one
Oh,
thing to get in there and start moving things around in terms of data, but I would
well.
imagine it's not rocket science to be actually able to listen in to what is going around on inside a semiconductor. That isn't necessarily going to be too complicated. I wonder about
Well,
how it works.
they can measure the data and stuff. They can gather tremendous amounts of data that way. I mean, things as simple as your cell phone. I mean, you may not know it, but they can turn the camera on. They can turn the microphone on your cell phone right now, and you may be being eavesdropped on and never even know it. But back to the military and the defense stuff. Essentially, you have a fighter pilot in his jet, chasing another aircraft to engage it. He fires the missile. And they now have the ability to have that missile turn around and come back and blow the guy who fired it right out of the sky. And they have the
How
ability to
do you
get,
do that?
well, you that's what this hidden circuitry that has been embedded in many of these devices. That's how they do it. They can just seize absolute control over it. And the same thing goes for any of these onboard fire control systems that are on the Aegis destroyer that's tasked with protecting carrier groups. All of these things can be hijacked and can be interfered with if this additional circuitry is in there, and it can be absolutely commandeered at any time.
Amazing. And also, of course, we're moving further and further away from human personnel and human decisions being made in these sort of situations. What do you make of it, taking a step back from all of this kind of military kit and hardware? the general state of play, because the Russians seem to have moved ahead very fast in the whole idea of ballistic missiles and these extremely fast delivery systems, the missiles that can fly around the world at incredibly high speeds, and allegedly very little, if anything, can stop them. And it's something that the West is way behind in that technology.
Well, that is a sad reality. The problem that the West has had for a long time, and I'll say the U.S. in particular, is let's look at the F-35 fighter jet platform. You know, that's supposed to be the all-weather night fighter, a next generation produced, but really it's junk, and it's overly complex. And they built it that way by design, with the intention of requiring constant upgrades for that system into perpetuity, which ensures them a better bottom line. They've put the model of profit over the model of warfighting capability. And the U.S. has really lost its way. And right now, the U.S. is manufacturing junk. And if you go to any of these air shows where they show all the products for everybody in the world, the Russians are outperforming the U.S. Orders of magnitude. And like I said, the U.S. is not a very good value for anyone who wants to buy a defensive system right now or anything to defend their country with.
Now, hang on a minute, because you're talking about this F-35, which is supposedly the new frontline aircraft, the most high-tech aircraft in the whole of the Western world. Now, we're talking about £80 to £90 million for one of these things, and that's junk?
Yeah, it is. Everybody who's got a cell phone, you'll be using your cell phone and suddenly it'll stop. It'll say, pause for an update. We get those for free on our cell phones. But the military has to pay for these updates on their systems, and they get charged for it. And so the idea is you build in manufacturing defects that need to be corrected as a function of time. This is a very pessimistic way to look at life, but this is how the military industrial complex in the U.S. does it. And that way they can build in a series of upgrades over the life of the platform, 30, 40, 50 years. And their cash flow never stops because these systems are not going to throw them away.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. The other thing I remember reading about the F-35 is that the design had a bit of a flaw with the spars that hold the wings on, and so pilots were advised, well, don't try and turn too tightly or the wings might start to actually, well, certainly cracks have appeared. So if you're trying to turn too tightly in this thing, that the wing might snap off. Now, this sounds like a bit of a design flaw for something that's costing so much.
Yeah, well, the nickname for the F-35 among those who are in the know in the military and the defense industry sector is the flying garbage truck. It's a piece of junk. I would be, if my son was active duty right now, I would not want him flying that aircraft. Okay,
nice.
Plain and simple, just don't want my kid in it. It's not robust or reliable enough. And I said the fundamental flaw is the defense contractors in the U.S. thought they had the world by the tail. Their arrogance and their hubris. They forgot their mission is to build effective fighting platforms, not to enhance productivity for our profitability for their shareholders. They lost their way. They forgot their primary mission, and that is why the Russians are producing vastly superior air platforms and virtually every other platform as well. You brought up the hypersonic missiles that the U.S. is 2 decades behind on. No one has even discussed the scalar weapons that Russia has demonstrated on the USS Donald Cook in the Black Sea when they had a premier Aegis destroyer helpless in the water for 14 hours until they decided to let it turn its power back on. But the Russians
hang on a minute. Hang on. Tell us a bit about that. Sounds like an incredible weapon. What went on there and when was this?
This was probably 7-8 years ago, I guess now, but the U.S. had put the USS Donald Cook into the Black Sea, and two Russian fighters flew over, and the entire ship turned off, shut down. And what the Russian technology enables them to do It enables them to shut off the flow of electrons within electronic devices. Aegis Destroyer is extremely electronics intensive. So they shut down the flow of electrons. So signal wasn't traveling from one device to the next device or the next device. The ship was dead in the water. And when the ship got back home, the entire officer corps of that ship resigned en masse because they felt they could not do their duty to defend their ship and crew. So the Russians have this technology, and they can turn off the flow of electrons in opposing enemies' electronics systems.
Well, amazing. And I hate to point it out, but these destroyers don't come in cheap, do they? Is it a guided missile destroyer? Is that what it is?
Well, it is. It's primarily the fire control mechanism for an entire carrier group.
Oh dear! So that entire carrier group is left with absolutely, effectively no headquarters, no brain. These things come in at over $1.8 billion, and yet the Russians can just flick a switch and turn the whole thing off.
And they demonstrated that on the Black Sea. That's like I said, several years ago. I can look it up here real quick and give you a date. But anyone who wants to look at it, look up the USS Donald Cook Black Sea incident.
Yeah, and, amazing.
The ship was dead in the water.
Yeah, it sounds to me as if
begun to show that technology yet to the West.
What you're saying here is that if we were to actually take on the Russians, it sounds to me as if we would lose basically. Anyway, you also worked in the financial sector. I think very few people, very few journalists have got really good insight into this because. What we've got, certainly here in the UK, is a national finance journalist's attitude in London, whereby what you do is you tell the public what the City of London want you to hear, and that's how you carry on in your job and you keep getting the leads and the stories. So you've effectively got the city writing the articles and actually scripting the TV pieces by these financial journalists in London. So I wonder if you could give us a bit of an insight into how things really work in the financial sector in the West. I mean, you've already explained here that the priorities in the military, a lot of them are financial and they're not actually about fighting battles. That's not the priority. The priority is finance. And what do you make of the very unhealthy situation we've now got in the West, where a lot of people have got used to cheap money and suddenly interest rates are starting to go through the roof?
Well, we're going to see a cascade of events happening. We have a lot of companies out there that are called zombie companies right now, and they're making enough revenue to service their debt. But they're not making enough revenue to hire new employees or to commence R&D. Are any of these things that grow a business. Now, with interest rates going up, are they going to be able to service their debt? That is the question. Are these companies going to be dropping like flies and going through bankruptcy? That's a very interesting thing to observe. The other major, major problem that the West has, and this is the collective West, not just the US, but all of Europe, the UK, everywhere, and that is with this derivatives market. There's a $2.4 quadrillion worth of derivatives exposure out there, and there's not $2.4 quadrillion on the planet. There's not that much value here. So they've oversubscribed this, and they've made up these financial instruments that if one defaults, it may cause another cascade of other of these derivative instruments to default. And so if that happens, the banks will lose their liquidity and will not be able to function as banks. So we're going to have the entire system seizing up. It's like an automobile engine running without oil. It'll run for a bit, but when it gets too hot and those cylinder or the pistons melt to the cylinders, it doesn't run at all. And that, I think, is something that we're looking at the global financial system doing here in the not distant future.
When?
Good question. That is the $64,000 question of the day. When? It's just a matter of how far can they kick the can down the road. They're doing things right now to protect the dollar because the dollar is also on the verge of losing its global reserve currency status. We're looking at what's going on with the BRICS countries, where they're building an alternate to the SWIFT system, which is going to break the City of London's stranglehold on the global financial system. And you're looking at countries like Saudi Arabia and China just met. And China approached Saudi Arabia if they would take yuan in exchange for their oil. And if that happens, and if it breaks the premise that the petrodollar is not the only currency that the Saudis or other oil-producing nations will deal in, then that again makes the dollar more rapidly lose its reserve currency status, and that's going to be an unmitigated disaster for anyone and everyone who is holding dollars and/or dollar assets. So I think people need to gear up and get ready for some very, very tough times. The situation that's going on in Ukraine is absolutely lunacy. The U.S. toppled the legitimately elected government of Ukraine back in 2014, and they installed Poroshenko, the chocolate king, as their puppet. And now they've got this Zelensky guy in there as the puppet. And Ukraine will not defeat Russia. NATO will not defeat Russia. Russia is stronger and more well organized, no matter what the propaganda tells you. Russia is winning decisively across that entire front. And the provocations, I blame this squarely on the U.S. and the Department of State, and in particular, a woman named Victoria Nuland. She shortened her name to Nuland. The U.S. is culpable for the situation in Ukraine. They're trying to portray the Russians as being the aggressors, when really it was the U.S. who went in there in 2014, toppled the duly elected government of Viktor Yanukovych, ran him out of the country, and installed their own puppet. And now, with the Nazification that's gone on, and with the shelling and murder of 15,000 Russian Slavic people in the eastern oblast provinces, if you will, of Russia, Russia intervened to protect people of their own genetic heritage. And Russian speakers, and they outlawed all things Russian, and they reclaimed territory that was formerly theirs. You have to remember that if you go back historically to the 7th, 8th, 10th century, Kiev was the capital of Imperial Russia, back when they were first forming the Russian Empire. And so this is all Russian territory. It has been for a very long time. And they're trying to make it act like something that happened under Nikita Khrushchev back in the 50s and 60s takes precedent over what's gone on for the last 1,000 years. And so, like I said, the U.S., the bottom line is the West needs a war. They need a global war of great scale because they've so screwed up their finances that they need war to act as a masking event, so that they can blame everything on the war and what happened in the war. And they think they can survive the war. They think they can win the war, but really they're not going to win this time. They're going to lose. And they hide their crimes under the fog of war. And these are the financial crimes that they've done of swindling people out of their property and their life's work over generations. And it's not going to work this time.
Looking back at 2018, fascinating article, I thought, in the it's kind of the Daily Mail. It's called This Is Money. And Mervyn King, the former Bank of England governor, who, by the way, his father was a railway porter, and he worked his way up through the Worcester Grammar School in the old system after World War II, where basically any kid of 11 years old at the 11 plus could get into, if they were academically minded, could get into a really good school. The idea really from the old Labour government after the war was they wanted academic, bright, working class kids to have as good an education as any of these rich kids could get in a private school. He said, Bank of England Governor Mervyn King, ex, said £166 trillion. Time bomb, he called it. Now, this is the ex-governor of the Bank of England saying that this was going to, he believed, crash the world economy. So I don't know if you could just explain a bit about the details of how something like that happens.
Well, I assume he was referencing derivatives again. And what it is, a derivative is essentially an insurance policy. But if the insurance company who's issuing the policy doesn't have the reserves to make the policy good, then they default. So if they default, then the company who is underwritten defaults. And then there's a chain of events that happens that any company that was doing business with them, because they can't meet their obligations, default. It's like dominoes, really. And that's how our financial system has been linked together. Now, during good times when the economies are growing and there's peace in the world, these derivatives, they're making a tremendous amount of money, and their balance sheets look good quarter to quarter and their annual reports, and everyone's making a bonus. But when things get tough and they're not making money and they're having a hard time servicing debt and paying their bills, and then an insurance policy or an insurance company defaults, then that's a very, very different scenario here. In the US, we're having a lot of insurance companies are really struggling right now because life insurance, the death from the COVID vaccine, the death rates are up 36% in the US over what was normal. So the actuaries did not know how to predict for this before the COVID vaccine came out. And so now the insurance companies are really struggling and having to liquidate other assets in order to meet their obligations on their
I mean,
life
surely,
insurance
surely
policy.
this is actually, this isn't too bad, really, because surely as people die and they have to pay out the life insurance, there's actually less money pension that needs to go to those people because they're dead. They don't need to get their pension anymore.
Well, yes and no. It's good on one respect, it's bad on another. If you've got a half a million or $1 million life insurance policy, and you've got to pay out, that's a bad thing for you, because if you're the insurer who's underwriting that person's life, you've got to come up with the $1 million. And if you're calculating a death rate, let's say 8% of the population, dies every year. I don't know what the number is. I'm just making something up. But let's say that number goes to 11%. And so now you're 3% higher of a death rate, and you've got 3% more policy you've got to pay out on. Where do you get the money for it? Because you didn't budget for that. You didn't. You're planning on a steady state of life and death at 8%. Now it's up to 11%. This really throws them into a tizzy. Now it may be good for the pension funds, but it's not good for those who are underwriting the life insurance. It's a double-edged sword.
Okay, and in the background, of course, we've got a potential crash. Now, I know that you're one of many now that is particularly concerned about this war in Ukraine, in that it could potentially be used as an excuse, well, to blame the war or actually an even wider war on these various financial ills. So when the chickens come home to roost financially, there will be all sorts of fingers to point. These are the enemy. These are the people that have done this to us.
Well, yes, we're seeing that in the U.S. already with how they're vilifying Putin. I mean, I'll go on the record right now. I'm a big fan of Putin. I think he is probably one of the best world leaders of this generation. And I say that because of how the quality of life for the people in Russia has improved under his leadership. And really, that's what a leader is measured by. Does he
Well,
serve the
hang
people?
on, because hang on, the same happened with Adolf Hitler, didn't it, in the 1930s? They had runaway hyperinflation. Hitler turned up on the scene, and everyone was loving him. The people that in Germany thought that he's doing a fantastic job because they had work again, and the hyperinflation was gone.
Yes, he economically he did a fabulous job. He didn't fight the war so well. He bit off more than he could chew. But as far as the German economy domestically, he was doing a brilliant job.
Claims of Putin invading Ukraine. There's also claims of war crimes that his soldiers are carrying out there.
Well, they're claims, but who's making the claims? It's the Ukrainian army. I mean, if anybody's been committing war crimes, I think the Ukrainians have been more aggressive on that than anyone else. And why is the U.S. supporting a Nazi regime in Ukraine anyway? It doesn't make any sense. They were our sworn enemies at World War II, but yet now
Well,
we're
hang
still.
on, again, you're saying a lot of stuff which is counterintuitive here. Zelensky's Jewish.
Why is a Jew supporting Nazis? It doesn't make any sense to me, does it? So maybe what we've been told about World War II was not as true as they'd like us to believe.
Well, maybe. No. Okay. So the last time we spoke a few months ago, you were talking about a website called Intel Doc. Sounded very interesting. You quoted a couple of stories from there. I did my best to share it with our listeners, but by the time we did, the site had vanished. I mean, can you tell us what was that site and what happened?
The site is still there. It's still up. It's still running. We had to move the hosting to Iceland, out of the U.S. We're constantly under denial of service attacks, but the site is up. It's still functional. It's the intel drop.com. I have a email there. It's mikeharris@theinteldrop.com. You can reach me at that site. And it's up, it's running. We're still producing what I consider to be cutting edge real intelligence.
Yeah, you've come back again. Well done. Can you give us an idea of who's behind the site, how it was conceived, and what the object is?
Well, a group from the Veterans Today group. There's really a core group there that decided that Veterans Today was under attack and under scrutiny by law enforcement agencies, and some people have been compromised, so they decided to make a separate site and take it offshore to where it couldn't be interfered with and meddled with by domestic U.S.
Many people listening will be thinking, well, if law enforcement are after you, what have you got up on that website? And maybe, that you've got something illegal, criminal, maybe incitement to crime.
None of that.
Why were law enforcement after you then? What was going on?
Well, we destroy their narrative. We tell countervailing narratives. We're watching this happen with what Musk is doing with the release of Twitter documents, where the FBI was suppressing the narrative about COVID and about Hunter Biden.
Okay, so can you be a bit more specific and tell us what exactly was in the lawsuits that the law enforcement people, I'm assuming this is the FBI, were getting? How were they getting your service providers to take the site down?
Well, I don't know, because they won't tell me. The FBI not, and the service providers will not. I don't have much to do with that side of the business anyway.
Okay.
So I'm not the right guy to ask that question of.
I know. How about an educated guess? What were you talking about at the time?
Well, suddenly there were just disclaimers coming up on there, about things. And it was inferring that there was some foreign backing to this. We don't take a dime from anybody. We do all this for free. We don't get paid to do this. So there was things that were illusory there, that were making it look like we could have been guilty of things and we were not. And so it's the best policy here is, keep your hands clean, live your life like a Boy Scout, and don't have any gray areas.
I'm trying to press you on this. Are we talking about stories to do with the Ukraine war or what?
Yes. The Ukraine war was a really hot button area there. And I'm sorry, but we don't buy the entire narrative that the entire U.S. government is giving out. Russia is clearly winning. The U.S. is culpable. The U.S. started this war. And the U.S. is directly responsible for this. And
what we're hearing is that actually Russia was invaded back in February 2022, earlier this year, and it's very difficult to say that that didn't happen, isn't it?
Russia, no one invaded Russia. Russia did come into Ukraine for what they called a police action, and that was to stop the murder of innocent civilians in the Eastern Oblast in Ukraine. And I'll compare this to the U.S. and Canada. Would the U.S. interfere? Would Canada interfere if the U.S. was suddenly murdering people in North Dakota and South Dakota? That's kind of what it was like there. That they decided to interfere and not let these people be genocided, because that's what was happening. And this was the Khazar Jews out of Ukraine who wished to reclaim that territory. as their own and make it into a second Israel, according to Benjamin Netanyahu. And so Russia said no, and they went in there and stopped it, and they stopped the Nazification. And that has been something the U.S. has been nurturing in Western Ukraine for a very long time. And these are things that nobody talks about, nobody knows about until this war. But the U.S. does not have clean hands on many geopolitical issues here. And what we do at the Intel Drop, as well as Veterans Today, is we call people out on these things. And we try to hold our government and our representatives accountable for these issues. There is a deep state, and it does a lot of terrible things. And we try to bring attention to this so that the American people don't get sold a bill of goods. I mean, it's just as simple as that.
Okay, so do you want to let us give us an idea of what you think, how you think this war is going? Because I remember chatting to one commentator right at the very beginning saying he thinks this could go on forever in Europe.
Well, it's not going to go on forever. It's going to go on until one side becomes so uncomfortable they don't want to continue. But right now, the U.S. Wants this war to go on, and they'll fight to the last Ukrainian. And I don't want to see that happen. I've been to Ukraine on a number of occasions. I like the Ukrainian people. They're nice. They're friendly. They have good food and pretty women. And I don't want to see anything unseemly happen to them. I don't want to see them killed by collateral damage. I don't want to see them killed any way, shape, or form. And the U.S. is in there meddling around. And you have to realize that the U.S. government is no longer controlled by the American people. We've had two stolen elections now where the elections have been interfered with. The elected officials who are representing us are not duly elected, and we're essentially an occupied government right now. And
who's occupying you?
Zionist occupied government, ZOG, ZOG. You look at our State Department, you look at our Treasury, you look at many Department of Homeland Security. All of these key positions are occupied by Zionist sympathizers. And that is something that we as American people don't want. We want a country that looks out for the American people and looks out for American interest. And that's what the fascination, why the popularity of Donald Trump, because what he was saying resonated with the people who want an American first foreign policy, an America first domestic policy. We don't care about the American empire going around the world. In fact, we don't want it because it's expensive and hard to maintain. We'd rather focus and make things as good as possible within our own homeland and not mess around with the rest of the world. We just have commercial transactional relationships with the rest of the world, not one of military occupation. Why does the U.S. have over 960 military bases around the planet? Why do we spend 10 times as much as any other country on the world for defense? You know, we're tired of this. We're neglecting our own domestic needs in order to put this military empire around the planet, and we don't want it. We reject it. We reject the course that our government has taken us on since the end of World War II.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? A lot of this seems to have started after World War II with the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, yes, it did. Well, you have to look. You know, the U.S. thinks they won World War II. They were a bit player in World War II. The bulk of the heavy lifting, at least in taking down the European theater, was done by the Soviet Union. They were the ones who did the heavy lifting. They sustained the most casualties. 20 million dead in the Soviet Union. The U.S., a fraction of that. The U.S. was far more active in the Pacific and had a better role there. But the U.S. has convinced themselves, because of their involvement in France and Western Europe, that they won the war when they really didn't win the war. As I said, they were a bit player. And if you look at things holistically, Russia had much, much more to do with winning World War II than the U.S. ever did. And but the U.S. was the main beneficiary because they were unscathed from the war. Everything else had to be rebuilt. And a lot of companies made tremendous profits on World War II. So they liked that profitability and they wanted it to continue. Since World War II, immediately afterwards, we're in Korea. Immediately after Korea, we're in Vietnam. And then the war on terror starts with Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, the U.S. has pissed away trillions and trillions of dollars fighting these useless wars that do nothing, that benefit, have no benefit to the taxpayers and the citizens of the United States. None. We can't even keep our own border safe. You know, so the other comment here I'll make is that the United States can't afford to go to war because we're so in debt already. We already have a $31 trillion debt outstanding. And then there's another $200 trillion of government obligations that are unfunded. So how can the U.S. afford to go to war with anybody? We simply can't do it. And we're weary of the war in Iraq. We're weary of 20 years in Afghanistan. Our military is worn out. It's fatigued. And we as a people have had enough of war. We would like some time at peace. I mean, it's
interesting. It's been going on my entire life. You started off, Mike, at Veterans Today. Tell us a bit about that site and how it's organized, because it does sound as if, you know, what that's about is members of the U.S. Armed Forces have actually been, in the field, coming back home and thinking, well, actually, I'd like to write about this. And, of course, you know, U.S. is you can't do that sort of thing in China, but you can in America.
Well, there is a strong influence of the U.S. military in Veterans Today. But let me give you a secret. What makes Veterans Today unique is that it's veterans. It doesn't say U.S. veterans. We have Russian veterans. We have Pakistani veterans. We have South African veterans. We have veterans from all over the world, virtually any jurisdiction, who write for Veterans Today. And so what it is, it's sort of a unique square where you can exchange ideas from different perspectives, men who've served, men who've fought, men who've been in battle. And it gives a really different point of view when you have, a Pakistani general writing an article for Veterans Today versus an American colonel. And so it gives a whole different flavor to it. But yet it is a broader exchange of ideas than you'll find virtually any place else.
Does seem to me as if we're dealing with a kind of deep state out there that has realized that it could try anyway to use the amazing invention called television to bamboozle the entire public. Because, I mean, there's so much going on out there that we hear nothing of. Sometimes you see stuff on Al Jazeera, English, for example. The BBC has none of it. The same often with the US network. So am I right? Do you think that the idea is that the wealthy elite, the warmongers, etc., have decided that they can get away with anything because they can bamboozle the public with the TV coverage?
Yes, because they control the media. They have a great deal of influence. And if you want to control a man's actions and his thoughts, control the information you give him. Now, I'll give you an example. This is a very simple example. A guy, Friday night, a guy's going to go out with his buddies and have a couple of cocktails at the bar. Calls the wife, say, honey, I want to stop with the boys and have a drink at the bar. She says, okay, great, I'll see you when you get home. What he doesn't tell her is that he was stopping at the Boom Boom Club where the naked female dancers are, and he's going to spend $300 before he gets home. He formed her opinion based on part of the information, not on the whole story. And that's what goes on with our news media. They don't tell the American people the rest of the story. They omit great swaths of things about it. I'll go back to the Twitter thing with the Hunter Biden laptop. When the FBI was actively suppressing news on Twitter about the Hunter Biden laptop, the same with the dangers of the COVID vaccine. There's a multitude of things that come out where, you know, our government and our news media have been compliant with suppressing information that the American public has a right to know. And
give us a quick, for those that aren't familiar with it, in a nutshell, what was on that laptop that was suppressed, and what was the significance of when it was suppressed?
Well, it was suppressed before the election, so that it would influence what people thought of Joe Biden and their opinion of him. And what is on that laptop is direct linking Joe Biden to acts of corruption, using his son Hunter as his bag man to pick up money from China, from Ukraine, from other jurisdictions, that wanted to buy influence with him while he was the vice president for Barack Obama. And that is what's on that laptop, as well as all sorts of other tawdry, debauched things that Hunter Biden himself was doing, his engagement with underage prostitutes, his drug abuse, his involvement with his dead brother's wife, sexual involvement with her, just a number of things are on that laptop. And
Well, okay, so that to me sounds like a kind of WikiLeaks that never saw the light of day.
it has not seen the light of day, and they're still struggling to get it out there. But the story is real. The laptop is real. The information on it is real. I mean, here's a guy, Hunter Biden, has no experience in managing money. He's never been a fund manager. Why does the Chinese government give him $1.5 billion to start a fund? And that's a that's pretty good money there. Why is he being paid by Burisma, a natural gas energy company out of Ukraine? And now here we are in a war in Ukraine. I mean, there's no coincidences. These things are all
No,
tied
that's right.
together.
I mean, one of the accusations we hear flying around is that actually at the top level, I mean, you could, I suppose, in the past anyway, point to Henry Kissinger and as one person doing this, is that there does seem to be quite a lot of quiet cooperation between China and the United States. Although, of course, in public and on the television, these two empires are daggers drawn.
Well, there are, and Kissinger was the guy who opened that up back in the 70s for Richard M. Nixon. He was the first guy over there. We don't know what promises he made, but there's obviously a very long and deep relationship there. And the way I think of it is if you watch the new James Bond movies with Daniel Craig, right? Well, the one Spectre is the one that comes to mind in particular. We're actually dealing with a transnational, transgenerational crime syndicate that has infiltrated our government and every government on the world. And Ian Fleming really kind of captured it pretty well in that James Bond series of movies there. They really tell the people pretty much what's going on. They paint them as being somewhat Germanic and Nazi looking, when really they're the Khazari and Zionist types. And they're but the premise is the same, that you've got a group of uber rich billionaires who engage in activities to make profit at any cost, no matter what it is, whether it's buying the water supply for an entire country, or whether it's the example where they were going to blow up that aircraft and shorted the stock, but Bond thwarted that. These are the kind of things that go on. And it goes on a global basis, on a daily basis. It's organized crime globally, and that's what all of us are dealing with here on a daily basis, whether we're aware of
Well,
it or not.
sounds to me like CNN, at the as the start of their news bulletin, should just scrap the newsreader and put a bit of Daniel Craig on to tell you what's going on. Anyway, look, what about the next year or so? And maybe you might want to even look back into 2022 as we go through the festive period. What are the big significant events, do you think, running up to this time? And then maybe if you'd like to do a bit of crystal ball gazing into next year.
Well, the two biggest events of the year were the Russian police action in Ukraine, number one. And then number two was the theft of the midterm elections in the US. That was the second time. I mean, we were predicting a red wave, all the polling data, all the people go out and vote. We're showing very, very heavily favoring Republicans, and they barely squeaked out a majority in the House of Representatives. Those are probably the two major stories of 2002. But what they've done is they've brought everyone's focus on the cheating that's going on and how to get our election processes so that they are not hackable anymore. I think you're going to see a migration away from these electronic voting machines and going back to hand ballots and hand counting, because that's turning out to be more reliable. Back in 2012, I gave an interview on RT Russia Today about the upcoming election between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. And I said these electronic voting machines are like the slot machines when you go to a place like Las Vegas. If the crowd is slow and it's not very active, they dial up how the slot machines pay out. So they pay out more jackpots quicker. So people win, they're happy, and they elevate the mood of the crowd because everybody's winning. But by the end of the evening, they dial them back down so that the casino takes back all that money at the end of the night and they make a profit. And that's how these voting machines work, is that they can be run offline to deliver any result you want. They can dial it up 2 or 3 points or dial it down 2 or 3 points, any way you want to do. And to date, these companies, Diebold or Dominion, have not allowed anyone access to their software and have not substantiated the vote. It's really a crime. But that's really what's going on in the U.S. As I stated earlier, we do not have a representative government anymore. It's really been taken from us with this election fraud. What's going to happen going forward? I think we're going to see some major financial shakeups here coming. I don't know when or where. I don't know how to predict them. But the House of Cards is encountering a pretty stiff breeze right now. The Federal Reserve is increasing interest rates. They say it's to fight inflation, which it is partly, but the inflation is caused by the U.S. government authorizing so much spending. Biden's several bills he passed added another $4.6 trillion to the national debt going forward, and so the Federal Reserve has got to protect the dollar by raising interest rates. And so we had 2 7.5 basis point raises, just had a 5 basis point raise, and they're not done. They're going to keep cranking this up, and this is going to cause a lot of stress in the U.S. domestic economy, and it may cause more business failures, more foreclosures, more bankruptcies, and it's really going to hurt a lot of people. And I don't know any way out of it at this point, because as I stated earlier, this derivatives problem we have out here with $2.4 quadrillion dollars. Now, 1 quadrillion is 1,000 trillion. They have 2.4 thousand trillion dollars of a derivative exposure out there. And as I said, there's not enough wealth on the planet to pay that off. So this could be some very interesting times going forward here.
Well,
And
look,
it's
this week, we've had the Russians saying that they believe that the United States and Russia could be on the brink of a direct clash. The Russian military says US-made missiles were shot down over Western Russia. Russian Defense Ministry said yesterday that 4 US-made AGM S, I think it's called an S-88 HARM. Anti-radar missiles were intercepted over Belgorod, an oblast in Western Russia that borders Ukraine. They're air-to-surface missiles that are designed to home in on electronic targets emitted by radar systems. The Pentagon revealed in August it began providing Ukraine with these missiles and said they could be fired by Ukrainian aircraft. So basically, the US is giving Ukraine some of its top kit. It starts to look like that this is a proxy war. The US is really at war with Russia.
Well, it is. It's been a proxy war, and the U.S. is the instigator behind it. I mean, look at the hundreds of billions of dollars in armaments that the U.S. has given Ukraine so far. And like I said, the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. They don't care about the losses because there's no voters here at home who are going to be arguing about it. But I really hate to see that happen to Ukraine. It's they're good people. It's a good country. I really hate to see it get any further. But it's also the most corrupt country on the face of the earth. It's the key of home of money laundering on a massive scale. That FTX crypto exchange, where that guy was getting a lot of crypto from Ukraine, and the U.S. the Democrats in the U.S. Congress are sending money to Ukraine. They're liquidating it, then they're sending it to FTX, and he's paying the Democrats in crypto coins that are untraceable to fund their campaigns and their personal lifestyles. That was a big reveal. That was a big one. And so, but you look at money laundering, you look at human trafficking, you look at organ trafficking, you look at drug trafficking, weapons. Ukraine is really the hotbed of corruption on this planet. And it needed to be cleaned out. I think Putin did the right thing. I support his actions 100%.
Okay, so what about the climate? We're being told in the West here, aren't we now, that we may have to switch the power off over winter. And apparently, sort of, I suppose, channeling and solidarity with the Ukrainians, who the Russian missiles are taking their power out. And we're being also told that we've got to go over to electric vehicles, this sort of thing. Now, a lot of farmers are raising their eyebrows. What do you make of the whole sort of COP process with Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, and King Charles trying to save the planet?
Well, I don't think they're trying to save the planet. I think they're trying to eliminate the populations of the planet. And that's how they plan on saving it, is by reducing the burden of humanity on the planet. You have to remember, it was not the Russians who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. And that is causing the deindustrialization of Germany right now. BASF Industries announced that they're leaving the country and moving it all to China because they have access to energy. And without access to energy, there is no industry. So this is a deep and complex subject here, but the WEF has, they're the ones who tell us that you will have nothing, you will be happy, and you will eat bugs. I don't care much for bugs. I don't buy the global warming argument. In fact, I think we're headed for a mini ice age. And I think that the sun has far more to do with climate and climate change, which has changed since dinosaurs roamed the earth, has been constantly changing, and is going to continue to change long after humanity is gone, because the sun has more influence on the planet in a day than all of humanity does in 100 years. So let's get things straight. This is a scam to get a carbon tax and take more money from the people, because the WEF and their ilk are essentially bankrupt. And they've overextended themselves. So they're trying to reduce the human population so that we remain controllable and they can stay in charge. And I don't support these people at all. I really don't. They have they offer no value to me. Neither do the I'll shut up.
Yeah. What about okay, so we've talked about climate crisis, we talked about Ukraine, military crisis for Europe anyway there, and even the possibility this week that there may be a direct clash between the US and Russia, which is obviously a bit worrying, as well as the potential for an enormous great financial crash. It does seem as if we've got, kind of multidimensional crises coming on us. And one group of people, these Nietzschean philosophers, that actually think this is a good thing. They hate this thing called the cathedral, they call it, which is, sort of civil society groups like trade unions, the religions, these kind of organizations, that they think this is a good thing. So what do you make of these? I think they call it the Dark Enlightenment, and they call themselves the accelerationists. They want to actually accelerate these crises to such an extent that it might actually bring the world to a grinding halt.
Well, in the U.S., the accelerationists are referred to as dominionists, and they're the ones who want to create the end world Armageddon scenario so that the Messiah comes back again. And like it or not, these people really believe what they're saying. You know, I don't think that they can do that. If there is a Messiah, if all of that happens, I don't think that their posturing, their little rain dance they're trying to do is going to make it rain. I don't think that if there is a Messiah, he'll come back when he's good and ready.
If you're talking about a Messiah, is this a kind of Jewish Messiah? Because the Jews have been waiting for many thousands of years for a Messiah, haven't they?
Well, they have, and in fact, there is a cloning operation going on in Georgia, the state in the U.S., right now, where they've got a red heifer without a white hair on it, and they're cloning it so they can get multiples of this red heifer, because they have to anoint themselves in the blood of the red heifer to walk into the temple. So that's they're actively preparing for this. There's lunatics out there who are actually doing these things, And quite frankly, people scare the heck out of me. I think they're out of their minds.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, yes, and I can understand that. If you look at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, right on top of that, which is where some of the Orthodox Jews, the Third Temple people, want to rebuild the, I suppose it's a temple after Solomon's Temple, if it's the third one, but they want to rebuild it there, and they've got this slight problem in that the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque is in the way.
Yeah, but you know, the Jews are used to getting what they want, and they're not going to let a few Muslims in their mosque get in the way. They are of such hubris that they will go in there and do whatever it takes. They don't care who they provoke. They don't care who they kill. But if they think they're right, they're right, and they will do it. That is the psychopathy of these Jewish zealots.
If this sort of thing kicks off, then I mean it's quite feasible that there could be almost like a it would be a kind of religious war breaking out, wouldn't it, in that part of the world between Islam and Judaism? Well, at least factions within those two, and goodness knows how that would go. Anyway, do you want to just round up by telling us what you make of the this sort of zing point of Jerusalem, because there seems to be quite a lot of focus on that, with almost in the background to all of this, you've got the Chinese who are quite supportive of the Palestinians, the US Christian Zionists, anyway, the deep state in the US, which is very supportive of Israel in every single way, almost in a biblical religious way. This could kick off there, couldn't it? Especially with the Israelis and all their nuclear weapons.
Well, it could, and that's one of the great deceptions of the 20th century, was that Israel's had a nuclear program for quite a while. They never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the U.S. government still sends them aid when we have laws on the books that say we will not support any government that that has nuclear weapons or proliferates nuclear weapons without signing the treaty. And so we're dealing with a bunch of hypocrites here, and we're living in very dangerous times. Let's just say that. That's all I can tell you. And I just hope that cooler heads prevail and that we get past this. I hope they lose.
Yeah, they will. Yes, I think there's much doubt that they will. But whether we'll be here to see it, you know, Mike, I'm not sure. Let's just wind up on, because I love the IntelDrop.com website, talking, for example, today about the link between Ukraine and drugs flooding Europe. I mean, this is something that we're not hearing on the news, and it's nice to see a detailed report there on the fact that Ukraine is actually one of the big centres around the world for organised crime. And they've got drug manufacturing plants over there, and they have their friends all around Europe that are peddling this dope.
Well, they do. As I said earlier, Ukraine is really the heart of corruption on the planet right now. Like I said, not just money laundering, but drug trafficking, human trafficking, organ trafficking. I mean, you want to buy a young girl, you go to Ukraine, you can buy yourself a 14-year-old. You buy a young boy, too, for that matter. And that's what Ukraine is. But these things wouldn't be going on unless government officials were getting greased, were getting paid to allow it to go on. So yeah, I look at the U.S. southern border. Why do we have this border crisis? Because El Chapo, when he was arrested and testified that he had paid Nancy Pelosi, the current Speaker of the House, $100 million U.S. dollars to keep the border open, and that he paid off others in our Congress. That's how organized crime survives, is they buy off our politicians. And I don't care if it's in the U.S. or if it's in the U.K. or Germany or anywhere. It's the politicians who take the bribes that enable this type of stuff. Now, the drug cartels in the Western Hemisphere, in Mexico and the U.S., they say, they have a saying that is, we will give you silver and buy you off, or we will give you lead and kill you. We expect our young 18, 19-year-old military-age men to go into almost certain death in combat situations. We expect them to, and not blink an eye, to do so bravely. We don't expect the same out of our politicians. We expect them to cower and buckle and take the bribe. That needs to end. We need to have politicians who have the courage of an 18-year-old soldier who's in the U.S. Army or any army for that matter. But we need to have politicians that have the bravery of soldiers, because they're handling the destiny of people in their hands. And they may get away with it for a short time, but they damage the rest of the population who they have the obligation to defend. And the politicians are coming, well, they said they're going to kill my daughter, or they're going to kill my son. Well, you're going to cause the death of someone else's daughter and someone else's son by taking the bribe. So don't take the bribe. Do your job or get out of the office. And stand down, let someone who has more courage than you do take the office, who has the courage to stand up to organized crime on a global basis. And
well, that's right. I mean, you know, we've got the situation in Europe as the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, this is a story on your intel drop.com today, is saying that something like a third of Europeans are using illegal drugs of one sort or another, and that there's been a big spike this year. What is this connection between the military and drugs? I think a lot of people aren't familiar with this, Mike.
Well, let me take you back to the U.S., the Iran-Contra hearings in the U.S. Congress, when Ollie North, John Poindexter, and William Colby were found guilty of drug trafficking to fund the illegal war in El Salvador. The U.S. Congress would not authorize funding for that war, and so they took it upon themselves to smuggle cocaine into the country, convert it to crack, and sell it into the black inner city. Okay, that is when police officers in the U.S. stopped carrying Smith & Wesson police specials, the five-round revolver, started having carried Glocks that hold 17 rounds because they were outgunned. That was a direct action of that. Then you look at the 20 years of the U.S. In Afghanistan and the problem with the opioids. The U.S. never had a major opioid problem until the U.S. had been in Afghanistan. So they used the same business model that they used to fund the El Salvador war to profit off of the war in Afghanistan. When the Taliban was in control of Afghanistan in the year 2000, Afghanistan produced maybe 200 metric tons of opium. When the U.S. left Afghanistan, or let me rephrase that, in the year 2020, when the U.S. was preparing to leave Afghanistan, opium production had risen to 9,800 metric tons of opium. So you look at how the opium production had skyrocketed in Afghanistan, and not just the U.S. opium problem, but the global opium problem had gone up exponentially as well. So, you know, we have this now. The U.S. is out of Afghanistan now, and suddenly the drug dealers needed a new product to sell. So now we have a fentanyl crisis in the U.S. that they're buying the precursors from China. They're making it in Mexico, and they're importing it into the U.S. And we're losing 110,000 people a year to overdoses. These are horrendous statistics and horrendous losses that the U.S. is taking. You can see the direct correlation between what our government does and how it treats us how it enables this drug business, and how it decimates the civilian population that our government and our officials are supposed to be protecting, but they don't, because they take the bribe and they get rich. Meanwhile, the rest of the country suffers under their alleged leadership here.
Also, just to wind up, we've had this week a supposed drop of files about the JFK assassination. Now, this was arguably an important turning point in U.S. politics, with Lyndon Johnson taking over, the Vietnam War kicking off again, which Kennedy was trying to stop. And what do you make of what actually really happened there? Because certainly looking at the hype around this and the articles in the London press about it, and probably in the US too, it doesn't seem to be much in this at all. What really happened to JFK and why?
Well, he was murdered. That's another hour or longer discussion that we'd have to have on this. But I was 9 years old when it happened. I remember it distinctly. I was in fourth grade. And essentially, we had a coup. Lyndon Johnson acceded to the to the presidency. He was not elected, and he ceded the presidency and took us promptly into Vietnam and escalated that war to, at one time, we had 530,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Vietnam. Spent, again, lots of money, 53,000 lives lost, millions of casualties on both sides, and for what? So somebody can make a profit. That's not the type of government that I want to live in. And I
No,
look back and
but
think to myself,
what really happened? Who killed Kennedy?
good question. I know the CIA was up to their eyeballs in it. The prevailing story I hear is that George H.W. Bush was the actual manager on the ground that coordinated the assassins that blew Kennedy's head off. There are multiple gunmen. There's a number of theories on this. I am not an expert on this topic, but a coup d'etat happened, and that was the beginning of the deep state in this country, where they murdered an American president in broad daylight. And just an example.
I mean, I
Every other
just find it
president.
amazing. I mean, we're just laughing here when we hear the newscasters talking about Lee Harvey Oswald did it. You know, he obviously didn't do it. Anyway, look, we've talked about veterans today, which is they're at veteranstodayoneword.com. We've also talked about the intel drop.org. Which is the website now moved over to Iceland and out of the clutches of the FBI. Could you give us a few tips about other places that good places to pick up world events? Because obviously, you know, we need to keep up to speed. We know we're being bamboozled by much of the mainstream press, aren't we, Mike?
Oh, we are. There's a couple of good news aggregators out there. Rumor Mill News is a good one, and Before It's News is another pretty good news aggregator. You've got to use some discernment. Some of the stuff on there is just nonsense, and other stuff rings true. But those are aggregation sites where they'll take publications and put all the best ones together for you. It saves time and effort searching.
And whereabouts can we find you?
That's about it. I keep a low profile. I do work on Press TV, as you and I have shared the stage there occasionally. I've been on Russia Today a number of times. I'm doing some work for Moscow Channel 3, Moscow Channel 5, and some Iraqi sites. But that's about it. I'm almost famous overseas, but here in the U.S., nobody's ever heard of me.
Well, I think that's a sign of the attempts to control the narrative in this kind of Orwellian fashion in the West, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you have to look at our news media. I mean, Ronald Reagan was going to deregulate telecom. And so at the time he did that, we had probably 153 networks from coast to coast. Now, some of these were regional and statewide, and others were national, but now we have a total of six networks. So anytime the government says they're going to deregulate something to make greater competition, what they're really going to do is consolidate something so that you have no competition. Same thing happened on the airlines here. We had 56 national carriers back when Reagan deregulated the airlines, and now we're down to five. So many of them have fallen away and been absorbed and consumed by the majors that they just don't exist anymore. But anytime a government tells you they're going to deregulate something, look for them. Look for a major consolidation and get out of the space.
Okay, from Veterans Today and the IntelDrop.org, Mike Harris, thanks very much for joining us.
Tony, thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.